From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, how math can help predict and stem the spread of disease.
And you use mathematics to try to extrapolate to a higher level of complexity. If we understand these interactions between individuals, how will this relate at the level of the city or the state or the region or the country?
Plus, we'll get some insight into the history of eastern forests and the political battles that shaped them. And musician and former Lake Effector Paul Schwarzkopf on a big musical challenge, naming his band.
I would come up with names like Subterfuge or something that sounded really exciting and explosive. And then I would always Google it, you know, Subterfuge Band. And then I would come up with about 15 to 25 MySpace pages with a band already of that name.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Of all the reasons people have for losing touch with mathematics in school, the one that probably tops the list is that it often doesn't seem relevant to the rest of the world. And while there is a lot of theory in math, a growing body of researchers are applying math in some surprisingly relevant ways. Like, for example, in public health. Dr. Carlos Castillo Chavez, who has degrees from UWM, UW-Madison, and UW-Stevens Point, is a leading mathematical biologist. His work involves using math to predict the spread of diseases like influenza and HIV. Castillo Chavez, who's now a professor at Arizona State University, is at the forefront of efforts to diversify the pool of students going into math and science fields as well. We spoke with him last month. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Pleasure to be here.
I want to start with the field in which you specialize. How is math related to the spread of disease?
It's very related because in mathematics, one often studies what is called a process of invasion, where a new species is going to arrive, where a new disease is going to enter.
Do you feel like is your work about looking at disease in a different way or math in a different way, or is this some combination?
It is a combination. From the biological perspective, it allows you to sort of use the information that you have at the level of individual, how diseases get transmitted, the contagion process, and so forth. And then you use mathematics to try to extrapolate that to a higher level of complexity. If we understand these interactions between individuals, how will this relate at the level of the city or the state or the region or the country? And in the process, a lot of mathematical and computational aspects appear, and that's part of the fun to work mathematics and biology together.
So if you're able to understand the spread of disease, like this person or this group is especially affected by influenza or HIV or whatever the disease is, if you're able to understand that by applying mathematical principles, does math also figure into the equation for limiting the spread of disease as well?
In fact, that's probably the strongest contribution of mathematics, particularly to public health, is to try to find out what are the pressure points of the system and try to see how altering those pressure points, how reducing the impact of those critical junctures can actually ameliorate the impact of infectious diseases.
Is it oversimplifying things to imagine this as a set of dominoes you're knocking down, and if you remove one of them, then the dominoes stop?
This is quite appropriate. In fact, in the case of influenza, they use terms like social distancing and issues like that. And so often people have created intervention plans that include isolating very sick people, finding who are the most infectious, stopping transportation systems, anything that you can do to reduce that the effect of that domino effect that you described.
Does math also figure into non-contagious diseases, diseases like cancers, for example?
Yes, they do. In some sense, the cancer is a similar kind of phenomena that some infectious diseases, except that these processes take within the immune system. So then you see how these cancer cells invade and take over internally within the body. So it's a process of invasion with the immune system. And this is where the value of mathematics comes from, because very different processes, once they are understood in this sense, they use the same kinds of mathematics.
Would you mind sharing your own story? You mentioned your postdoc work at Cornell, but well before that, I gather math was not your first or maybe even your second love.
Yeah. My first love was probably acting. And I think I made the right choice, and you just proved me right by listening to you. But my interests have been eclectic. I've been very interested in literature, in the social sciences. I think at the heart, probably in terms of the scientific field, I probably would be more a social scientist. But when I attended the school at the University of Wisconsin over Stevens Point, which it was a wonderful institution for me, then I realized that I could do also mathematics, and some people encouraged me to go into mathematics, most likely to discourage me to going into acting and literature. And from there, I moved to the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, where I found that really a most fascinating city for its diversity and the kindness and collegiality of its people. And I really enjoyed my years at Milwaukee.
Well, and if I understand correctly, your family immigrated to Wisconsin when you were in your 20s, is that right?
Yeah, I immigrated. I actually work in a cheese factory. I live in Merrill, Wisconsin, and work there. And then that's sort of the best way to find out that you really don't want to work in a factory is to actually work on one. And then I decided I better go back to it, get it myself educated, and see if I can do not less work, but less harder work, because people that work in factories work really, really hard.
Were you encountering roadblocks even at that time? This was the 1970s. I imagine there was not an enormous immigrant community that was attending UW-Stevens Point. Were there roadblocks for you?
There were actually two Hispanic students at the university, and we immediately encountered each other and became friends. I found the population that attended the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, mostly they came from Wisconsin. Clearly, they had some stereotypes. But it was nothing that could not be resolved by some sort of discussions and engaging them. But the biggest problem that I had there was actually financial. So at one point, I was, I believe, $400 short of money to graduate. And at that point, I tried to get some sort of financial aid. I couldn't. So one day, accidentally, I found on the street, pretty much going towards his office, the chancellor of the university, which was Lee Dreyfus, which later became the governor of the state. So after I approached him, he was returning from China. He was telling me all sorts of things. And he traveled a lot. Nobody seems to be waiting for him. So he took me to his office. He showed me how to write his name in Chinese and all these wonderful stories. And then I explained him my problem. And he immediately picked up the phone and called the financial aid office. And he asked them that to facilitate $400 for me so I could graduate. They told him that I had seen them many times and they had told me no. And I remembered with his words, you know, you forget who you're talking to. I'm the chancellor of the university. I said that you should get this young man $400, send the right letters. I revised them. And we'll be sure that he graduates. And I did graduate. And those $400 were marvelous. So that can tell you the kind of environment that you have at UW-Stevens Point, where you have this red-vested man that was actually wonderful.
What sort of interest did people in the math department in those days have in diversifying the pool of people who were going into those fields?
That was the time when there were the initial discussions that I heard in Wisconsin about affirmative action and so forth. And there were some divisive issues. And for the first time, they began to trouble me. It was a little bit in contrast with the situation that you saw in the city. I worked for then Spanish-speaking Rich Outreach Institute. We grew up out of the result of Hispanic parents and minority parents complaining and having sit-outs, and that increased the role of the community on diversifying UWM. So there were some issues associated with that. And the biggest problem is always not having a critical mass, some issues of isolation and things like that. But I was a little older student then, and so So I was able to manage that and then also get married, had children, and it, you know, your priorities become different, but they do affect you.
In comparison, how do you see the climate today? I mean, you work a lot at encouraging students who have been underrepresented in STEM fields. Are the hurdles institutional today, or are there sort of bigger, more amorphous societal factors at work?
I think that there are still institutional hurdles. I think that there is a lot of economic hurdles. I think that the landscape of how people feel about the people of color in general has improved dramatically. A lot of things have changed. But I think that the political situation, particularly during political season, tends to force people into corners where they don't want to be. We saw that with the immigration issue. We have seen that with socioeconomic issues. And during those periods of time, the tensions and the impact of the small percentage of really negative people that we have in the country, very small percentage but very vocal, tends to create some sense of uncertainty. But after a while, you know, as we see now with the immigration issue, things start to become more normal and the search for solutions become more bipartisan and so forth. But there are periods of time, particularly during elections, where things still turn out to be complicated.
You were previously on the faculty at Cornell. You're now at Arizona State. How do you see the role of state universities like ASU and places like UWM, for that matter, in research versus the places that have or once were seen historically as the academic elites?
Well, number one, I don't think that you can be an effective educator if you are not doing state-of-the-art research. It just would be like going to see a physician that has not opened a book for 20 years. So, number one, I think that the role of public universities is fundamental because what one would call the elite, or my president calls President Arizona State boutique institutions, they're extraordinary. And I had a great time when I was there. But they educate a very small percentage group of the population. And the majority of Americans don't go to these institutions. And they need to have access to institutions where the kinds of intellectual opportunities and challenges are identical. So they cannot be effective public institutions unless they have faculty engaged in first-rate research. But there are differences. Number one, one of the first challenges is how do you provide a quality education to a large number of students? Public institutions give access, but now they have to provide as good education as they would do in the Ivy League schools. And secondly, the faculty at these institutions, they should be engaged also in research that improves the states, that improves the country, that has much more impact than some of the research that other institutions can engage in. Not less quality of research, but I think the research that has more direct impact in what people are interested in.
Carlos Castillo Chavez, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Carlos Castillo Chavez is our Regents Professor of Math Biology at Arizona State University. He has degrees from three Wisconsin State Universities, Stevens Point, Milwaukee, and his doctorate from Madison. In April, he was reappointed to President Obama's Committee for the National Medal of Science. Keep listening. When we return, our forests are facing dangers on several fronts, from invasive beetles and an abundance of people. We'll talk about what's significant about America's eastern forests when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Next week, we'll get an update on Wisconsin's efforts to cope with the emerald ash borer, an insect which threatens to kill millions of ash trees in Wisconsin and other states in the Midwest and eastern United States. The invasive species is one of only many biological and policy issues currently facing forests, and it's only the latest chapter in a complex history that's led to the creation of the National Forest System. Writer Christopher Johnson details much of that history and the issues surrounding national forests in a new book called Forests for the People, The Story of America's Eastern National Forests. He's with us in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me, Mitch.
What makes eastern national forests distinct from the system of national forests at large? What are the issues that are specific to them versus national forests in the Southwest or in Alaska or across the system?
The big difference is water. in the Eastern National Forest, which we generally think there are a few in Minnesota that are west of the Mississippi, but really the primary dividing point is the Mississippi River. And so when we talk about the Eastern National Forest, we're talking about two regions of the Forest Service. One is for the Midwest, centered in Milwaukee, and the other is for the Southern Forest, and they are in Atlanta, Georgia. And so those what distinguishes them is that there is plenty of water. When you go out west to the national forests of Arizona or New Mexico, there is much less water. It's a much more arid environment. And as a result of that, the eastern forests followed very different paths. But there are also other differences having to do with how this country was settled and cultural differences and so forth.
Well, let's talk about some of that early history and about what the first attitudes towards forests were, which I gather were fairly similar in the Northeast and in the Lake States.
They absolutely were. The heavy logging really started during the colonial era in New England, and it continued. And then when the Industrial Revolution really took off in the 1840s, 1850s with the Civil War, then you saw very heavy logging in New England and a process that we call clear cutting, where the loggers would go in and they would just cut all the trees, regardless of their maturity or their size, an entire tract. And in the late 1800s, this was having a devastating impact on New England's forests. And so you started to see a forest conservation movement build up around that, particularly because these areas had become very popular for tourism.
Well, and when you talk about the heavy impact they had, this is not just on the scenic beauty. I mean, not just the fact that there were large pieces of forest that were suddenly gone, but there were some real natural kinds of other impacts that happened down the road from them.
There certainly were. What you found were huge forest fires. When the logging companies would go in and do the heavy logging, they would leave a lot of the limbs and the canopies, the trees on the ground, and these would dry up, and they basically became kindling. So in the late 1800s and early 1900s, you had huge forest fires. And this had a huge impact on the economic development in Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont, because people they wanted to go see beautiful forests, and it was really interrupting the tourism. But it was also really having an impact on the rivers and streams. What happened was that as the forest disappeared, water would run into, during storms, would run into the streams and rivers, and you had enormous flooding. And this had huge economic impact on Manchester and other cities along the rivers in New England. You also had silt. They were experiencing silt and buildup of the rivers and streams. And this actually became a key element in passing legislation that helped to restore those forests in the eastern United States. And then what you found was that the loggers had really clear-cut a lot of the forest land in New England, and so they looked to the Lake States and they did the same thing. Michigan had huge forests of beautiful white pines, and at that time, Chicago and Detroit and the other Midwestern cities were growing rapidly. So there was a huge demand for these trees, and white pine just made great lumber. So again, logging industry came in and clear cut the white pines in Michigan and northern Wisconsin, and then they moved to Minnesota. So you had the same experience where these forests were really devastated and there was no movement to restore them or to keep the forests logged on a sustainable basis.
Well, and I gather that's what really ended up driving the conservation movement in the Lake States, was a desire to manage them sustainably so there would be a future supply of timber for use in building materials.
That's right. In all three Midwestern states, after the loggers came, the economic devastation followed in these small towns in northern Michigan and northern Wisconsin. And the state legislatures were really, in the early 1900s, were trying to figure out ways to make these areas, these counties, productive again. They even encouraged farming in the northern counties. And that didn't work so well because there were like hundreds of stumps that had to be removed. The soil was not any good for farming. And as anybody who vacations up there knows, the climate is not really conducive to farming.
The growing season's about 3 weeks long.
It's about 3 weeks long. That's right. And so it was kind of a boondoggle. But there are reports in the early 1900s of researchers would go into these towns where farmers were trying to, desperately trying to farm these cutover lands, and it just was not working. And it added to really a depression type of environment. And the tourism had not developed to the point yet in the early 1900s that that could provide, you know, bring money into the northern counties of all three states.
When did the wilderness movement come into the equation?
That really started after World War II. 1911 saw the passage of the Weeks Act, which allowed the federal government to buy these cutover lands and restore them. And that happened in the East and in the South and in the Midwest. And so the Forest Service led the way in a really an incredible restoration of these forests.
How did they do it?
How did they do it? They went and planted. During the Civilian Conservation Corps planted millions of trees, you know, and little they would grow seedlings in nurseries, and then they would take them out to the forest and they would plant them. And one of the interesting things is the United States, the forest has tried to replicate the look of the forest. They had learned a lot of these forestry techniques from Germany and France. Well, when you went to restored forests in Germany, they were all planted in rows. You know, kind of a, you know, and
as you would expect, the Germans
you might expect,
to
very
plant a
orderly
forest.
Approach. So, and early foresters like Aldo Leopold, who would later become one of the founding fathers of the ecology movement, went there, just were appalled at this. And so they encouraged and trained foresters to try to replicate the look of forests as they did replanting. And also, as I mentioned, there was plenty of water. So these forests did naturally regenerate. Seeds would flow, you know, they would, the breeze would blow. Birds would bring them in. There were just many ways in which, and because of the ample rainfall, these forests did regenerate themselves. But what was key was putting in techniques for sustainable forestry. The national forests are used to provide lumber to us, but they do so on a sustainable basis. And so there was a major effort in order to learn and teach these techniques of forestry. What happened with the wilderness movement is that in the economic boom of the 50s and early 60s, then the Forest Service started allowing clear cutting again. And there were two major incidents that happened in the early 60s, one in on the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia, the other in on the Bitterroot National Forest in Montana, where areas that tourists and hunters and fishermen liked were clear cut. This led to just a huge outcry and accusations that the Forest Service was not managing the forests for all uses. You know, that's the philosophy, multiple uses, which includes recreational use, hunting, fishing, as well as hiking and camping. So there was a feeling that the forests, so that some of the national forests need to be preserved as wilderness. And so that really gave an impetus to the passage of the Wilderness Act in 1964, through which parts of many national forests were set aside. No vehicles of any kind, no logging, no mining, no drilling for oil or natural gas. They were really managed. They were really allowed to develop as wilderness. And so they became a very important part of the ecology of national forests, as well as popular among recreational people who wanted to go into them and to be able to hike in areas that really felt pristine. And the word pristine is used in the Wilderness Act. These areas are to be kept pristine.
Well, and you write – you make an interesting point in this book. You know, we tend to think of wilderness and preservation and economic development as an either-or sort of equation. But you write about particularly the areas in the Monongahela and the Boundary Waters canoe area wilderness as examples that economic development is not necessarily distinct from wilderness preservation.
That is a really important point. And when I was reporting the Monongahela National Forest, there was a push among people who wanted more wilderness in West Virginia in the 1980s and 1990s. And one of their major arguments was that West Virginia has beautiful forests, that this was an untapped resource for recreation. So I went out there twice to talk to people, to observe, to hike through the forest myself. And I just found that there's a whole infrastructure that has built around recreation in West Virginia. And a lot of small businesses have participated in the campaign to get more wilderness, because that is what draws people. West Virginia is in the east, and there are not that many pristine wooded areas left in the east, particularly that are hilly, that are good for climbing. And so there's just a lot of advantages to preventing these areas from being devastated by coal mining or heavy logging and that sort of activity.
Well, let's flash forward to the 21st century. You write about the encroachment of the emerald ash borer, specifically in Michigan's national forest, but obviously it's an issue facing forests in Wisconsin and really throughout the East now. Would you say, is that situation with that particular invasive emblematic of a larger issue facing forests in the 21st century?
It's one of the big threats. What's happened is that with globalization, insects and diseases can more easily travel around the world. And the emerald ash borer was something that we decided to write about because it really is that has had a huge effect on the Midwestern forest. It makes a good case study for invasive species because it was an insect that is found in China. And it doesn't harm the ash trees in China, which have evolved to resist the insect. However, the ash trees here did not have those natural defenses against the insect. And so it was able to spread and to infect ash trees. And really, the biologists so far have not found ways to defeat this insect. And it's just one of many, many insects and diseases that are really threatening forests around the world. And it's a huge matter of concern that botanists, biologists are working to try to solve.
You also pose the question of whether there are some forests that are at the risk of being loved to death, which is a term that's also been applied to some national parks. What are you getting at when you write that?
Well, I co-wrote this book with a forester from New Hampshire named David Gavoxy. David told me that after parts of the White Mountains, which is where he lives, were approved as wilderness. You know, to create wilderness takes a an act of Congress. And after this was done, all of a sudden these wilderness areas were more popular than they had been before. There's just something about that word wilderness that attracts people. This is a big reason why people visit national forests. There are certain national forests that are really in the danger of being overrun. And not only are they overused, you do find in the White Mountains in certain areas that there is some limitation on the number of passes and number of primitive camping permits that are granted for that reason. But another danger is just the whole attraction of living near these pristine and beautiful areas. We write in the book about Vermont and North Carolina, where people, these exurban areas where people are buying homes that back right up to the national forests. And that presents a problem, a big problem, because it creates air pollution, water pollution. You get more sidewalks. You get more driveways, which increases flooding in the accompanying rivers and streams. It also reduces the habitat connectivity, and that has an effect on wildlife. So in Vermont, there have been problems with bears and other animals that hibernate, other animals that migrate from north to south, and they have fewer paths for migration than they did because of the overdevelopment. So this idea of overdevelopment is really having an impact on the national forest.
You mentioned your co-author is a former forester. What about you? Where does your own interest in this subject come from?
Well, we lived for many years in Boston, and we had grown up in the Midwest, so I wasn't that familiar really with forest and mountainous areas. But as we raised our children, we would go hiking and camping and do the things that you do, particularly in Vermont and New Hampshire. And I started reading about the region, and I started reading some of the history of the region. And the history of those states is just so intertwined with logging, with railroads. I found that fascinating and started researching it and writing about it would write about magazines. In 2006, I wrote a book about the White Mountains called This Grand and Magnificent Place, which is about the hotels and the forests and how they were threatened. It was about the passage also of the Weeks Act and the development of wilderness. It was what I discovered in researching that book and that David and I carried into this book is that there – when we talk about the forests of the United States, first of all, they're an extraordinary accomplishment, that restoring these forests. And I think the country should be proud that we have done such a good job with these restoring and managing these forests. But that when we talk about protecting them, first of all, they are a fragile environment. They can easily go away. And that when you talk about them, there's so many factors that come together. There certainly is ecology, the ecosystem of the forest, which we know so much more about than we did, but also their economic, their social, their cultural forces at work in protecting and respecting and managing the forest. And I think that has been my biggest takeaway in doing the research over the years about these forests, is that they're really systems that require us to look globally, to think holistically about them. You can't separate one aspect, like the ecosystems, from economic development and from the culture. The culture is so important, you know, so intertwined with the forest. The lore, the stories that people tell, which are just wonderful, have to do with the stories. And it has to do also with the value that local residents place on these forests and the way that their lives are really intertwined and their family histories are intertwined with these forests. And that was just one of the most fascinating things to me, the poetry and the stories that people told about these forests.
In a way, you're seeing the forest for more than the trees.
That's exactly right, yes.
Chris Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, Mitch.
Chris Johnson is the co-author, along with David Gavatsky, of the new book, Forests for the People, the story of America's Eastern National Forests, published by Island Press. Johnson lives in Evanston, Illinois, and you'll find a link to more information from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A majority of the people who live in Milwaukee are from this state. What economic difference does that make? A Lake Effect essayist has some thoughts when we return on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. Where are you from? Ask that to the next person you meet on the street in Milwaukee, and they will probably look at you funny. So instead, take our word for it. The answer is probably someplace local. Writer and Lake Effect essayist Avi Lank says where we are from says a great deal about where we're going.
Thanks to my old Journal Sentinel colleague Rick Rommel, I now know what I am. A proud member of the 28%. The number comes from a passing reference Rick made in a recent series on the economic past, present, and future of our community. In it, he notes that about 72% of Milwaukee area residents were born in Wisconsin. Only 6 of the country's 50 largest metros have a larger share of home state natives, he writes. Rick leaves it at that. And while a large concentration of the native-born is not as great an economic challenge as poor schools and racial segregation patterns that are among the nation's worst, it does not help grow the community either. In fact, it may retard growth. My wife and I are among the 28% from elsewhere. We have lived in Milwaukee since 1974. I ate at the Heinemann's Men's Grill. My wife banked at the Marine. But because we were born in other states and did not go to high school here, natives will never consider us real Milwaukeeans. When we moved here, my wife and I were the kind of people development experts say are needed to put yeast into an economy, young and college educated. We had no friends or relatives in the state. Milwaukeeans were polite but standoffish. It has worked out fine, however. We came here looking for opportunities greater than those available in our much smaller hometowns, and we found them, making satisfying careers, raising a family, paying taxes. We have contributed in many ways to making Milwaukee a better place, love living here, and are proud to call it our hometown. We have developed a wide and deep circle of friends. but almost all of them moved here from elsewhere. In the four decades we have lived here, we have been invited into the homes of only a handful of people who went to high school in Milwaukee. When I came here, Alice Chalmers ruled the economy and personal computers were only a gleam in someone's eye. A high school education got you a good job, perhaps at a place that had employed your family for generations. Those days are gone, but the insular attitude they fostered remains. As Rick's series lays out, it has taken our leaders a long time to adjust to this, but it has taken the population even longer. And the problem is greater than just looking askance at folks from out of town. During a recent stint counseling people on credit problems, I would often ask a client if they were from Milwaukee originally. It was common for the reply to be something along the lines of a scandalized and completely unironic, "Oh no, I have lived in St. Francis all my life." That worldview is a difficult hurdle to jump when our economic future depends not only on understanding that a job for a person in St. Francis might be a Menominee Falls, but when farsighted economic development of Milwaukee would also do all it could to foster a closer attachment to the world-class economic engine less than 100 miles to our south, Chicago. Insular smugness does not mix well with growth.
Avram Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and Journal Sentinel for more than 35 years. He lives in Whitefish Bay, and his freelance work has appeared in Milwaukee Magazine and Corporate Report Wisconsin Magazine, among other places. A final break, and when we return, the return of a former Lake Effector, Paul Schwarzkopf, another WUWM alum with musical ambitions. We will chat with him when we return on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. It's been a while since the name Paul Schwarzkopf showed up in the Lake Effect credits, but a few years ago he was a production assistant on this show, and probably the vast majority of segments that aired between 2006 and 2008 ran through his capable editing hands. Paul moved on to the next phase of his career and the next location, the Twin Cities, where, among his other pursuits, he established the electronica band Manual Controller. The band describes its sound on its Reverb Nation site as like a garbage truck full of microwaves. Judge for yourself. This is the ninth track on the CD, Salutations, a song called Moreland Road. Paul Schwarzkopf dropped by the Lake Effect bungalow not too long ago and chatted with our Dan Harmon. He explained, first of all, what the name Manual Controller implies.
It's funny because I spent like years trying to come up with the perfect band name, which I think everybody in a band or making music always tries to do. And I would come up with names like Subterfuge or something that sounded really exciting and explosive. And then I would always Google it, you know, Subterfuge Band, and then I would come up with about 15 to 25 MySpace pages with a band already of that name. So I was getting really frustrated because I was eventually hoping to put out some music and couldn't come up with a name. So I resorted to the internet again and used an automatic band name generator, which I don't know if you've heard about these things, but they're extraordinary.
I've not heard of that, no.
Oh, they're extraordinary. Not just for coming up with band names, but for anything. If you need a name of a restaurant, you can just type in, like, I want it to sound like bagels. And then they'll come up with, like, a bagel explosion, deliciousness, and stuff like that. So actually, Manual Controller came from an automatic band name generator. It means – oh, and it has some meaning to myself, but it's basically nonsense.
It seems really appropriate given the nature of your music being electronic – music generated from electronics. So it would make sense that it would be generated from the internet.
Yeah, I guess so. And another kind of meaning that it has for me is I use all hardware, so I use all tactile synthesizers and drum machines. So I'm manually controlling them as opposed to kind of using a computer to synchronize everything. So I guess it kind of has like an inner, deeper, stronger meaning for me there.
All right. Well, I'll just remind you and I'll tell bands out there, it's too bad you did not use Lake Effect as a resource, because we have a list of hundreds of band names that just come from casual conversations. Maybe we'll put this online sometime, but we literally have, I think at this point we're approaching 500 band names. So if anyone out there is looking for a band name, you just need to consult Lake Effect.
Oh, hot dang.
Or if you ever want to change your name.
Sure. Okay.
Okay, which I'm not suggesting that you do.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you about the electronic aspect of your music, because there are electronic bands in Milwaukee, and I realize that's a category that's very general and you can sub-specialize within there. So why do you think that style of music you live in Minneapolis now, but you're from the Milwaukee area.
Yes.
Why do you think that has not caught on per se in Milwaukee? We're still pretty much an acoustical town. I guess you could say that about many places.
I think the tricky thing about electronic music is it's probably there, but it's probably not being presented. I think it's a lot of people kind of sitting in their basements or in their attics, in my case, and just kind of making music and perhaps not presenting it to a wider audience. I mean, if you go onto a website like Reverb Nation or SoundCloud or something like that, you'll find hundreds and hundreds of electronic music artists in different cities, be it Milwaukee or Minneapolis, Seattle, wherever. But it seems like rock bands, you have four people, you get together, you're like, hey, I got four songs. All right, let's go play it at a bar. Joe's a bartender. He'll get us in. So I think it's harder for a dude or a chick sitting in their studio, you know, messing around with stuff to actually go out there and start showcasing it to the world. I think it's kind of like an insular – it's like poets. Like, man, there's like – you know, oh, this town isn't known for poetry, but there's probably like 5,000 poets just sitting there scribbling on a notebook in their own blood or ink or whatever, making crazy nonsense. So why it hasn't like kind of exploded, I don't really know.
Well, I'm wondering if it just hasn't caught on in general. It's kind of, and that it's more of a specialized niche in the music market.
I think so. I mean, I think electronic music, I would say, is probably at its, the 80s, it was really popular and in pop radio, et cetera, and a lot of electro bands kind of playing. But I think it's actually with the technology that's now available and the amount of people that have access, you just need a computer and like a couple gadgets and you can make electronic music. You don't need five guys sitting in a studio. So I think in that respect, there's a lot of it, and if you listen to pop radio, I mean, that's all it is nowadays. That's just – it's, you know, you could have Rihanna or insert pop songwriter, pop star here. It could – it's all electronic, and it's all derived from electronic music from the 80s, from the 70s, from the 90s. It's all come together now as this just like mega synth pop.
Maybe tell us a little bit about the solo aspect of it. It seems generally when we have musicians on, most anyone that's solo is a guitarist or maybe even a harpist. But when
that
it comes,
would be impressive.
Okay, yeah, when it comes to most of our musical acts, they're plural. There are multiple people, so the whole multiple band member thing. And you've been in a band before with other people, so but now you're solo. So how different is that whole process? I mean, you have to self-motivate. You have to you create everything yourself. So how is that different from being in a more collaborative, or unless you have multiple personalities?
I do. And now the Scottish one's going to come out. So, well, you see what's different is – no, I'm just kidding. The thing about being – you know, I've been in a bunch of different bands, and it's always – been a collaborative songwriting process. So you're always like, oh, dude, I got this sweet bass lick. And then so the guy lays down the bass lick and then the guitarist comes in and then hopefully the vocalist, if he shows up, puts down some sort of brilliant vocal line. You know, and then I add the drums because I'm primarily a drummer. And so it's more of a collaborative process. So yeah, by myself, you got to do it all by yourself. And the reason I went that route is because I was in so many bands that just broke up. We couldn't ever keep our act together. I was in like, I don't know, six bands. And it was like, this is the band. I'm finally going to actually perform somewhere and maybe actually record something that somebody would want to listen to. And it never, ever happened. So I really became started making my own music out of the fact that I just couldn't take it anymore. And I don't have an ego. I've destroyed my ego to the best of my ability. But I just got so bored of not ever going anywhere and ever sticking together and propelling forward. So, yeah, so I went started making my own music. And, yeah, you have to – it's exhausting. To actually finish something takes forever. It takes – you have to write the structure of the song, program the drums, put this, all the stuff over it. If you want other musicians to come in, talk to them, bring them in, have them overdub stuff. Then you got to mix it, master it, make the CD art. It was an exhausting process. Right.
So going from an acoustical, I'm assuming these weren't electronic bands.
No, they were all, yeah, acoustical.
So you go from that to electronic music. So you must really have been sick of it.
The thing about electronic music is you don't need other people. You're able to create all the parts by yourself. And I have a love for electronic music. I didn't do it as a, as a default to I can't find anybody else to play with. But I mean, you're able to just make the music by yourself, which is very, very helpful. So it was a natural shift. It's like, crap, I'm by myself. I have this desire to make music, and I don't play an acoustical instrument such as an acoustic guitar. So I had to learn the keyboard, and I've been a drummer, and I figured out how to use synthesizers after a while, and then I just kind of went from there.
Okay. Well, enough talk about electronic music.
Sure.
We heard some introing into this segment. So let's listen to a couple more songs. I think we're going to listen to a little bit. We're not going to play the whole song. It's a little bit about the song Brevity, right?
Brevity. Brevity was the
one. Want to set it up for us?
Sure. So Brevity, it was called Brevity because it was supposed to be ridiculously short. I was going to make it like 30 seconds. The intro synth loop that you hear was just going to be the whole song. I was just going to have it do it, and then it was going to stop. But then I started monkeying around. I write all my songs like structure-wise on a crappy Casio keyboard. So I was sitting there monkeying around, and I had this other part written that I happened to realize was in the exact same key and happened to do, you know, kind of meld together. So you'll hear kind of like a beginning, a middle part, and then an outro-ish segment. And so I kind of combined all those together, and I just didn't feel like changing the name because I guess because I'm lazy. More or less.
Okay, so that's Brevity. What does that fall in the spectrum of your work, I guess? Is it harsher? Is it more melodic?
I'd say it's more melodic. It's all a really basic sequence of chords. It's almost like Latin chords. They're like, I don't remember the key it's in, but they have kind of like a Latin flair to it. And my goal was, another reason trying to tie back to Brevity was nothing lasts for more than, I don't know, 15 seconds, 8 bars, something like that. It constantly changes. So it's like, especially the middle part, I just, as I was working with it, I kind of had these Latin chords going, and I wanted to hopefully just have that be the song, but it was getting really boring in my ears because they're not really that interesting of chords. They're not that complicated. So I just had, I wanted it to just be this explosion of sounds constantly changing and coming in. So I had like this, you know, crazy pan synth part come in. It sounds like, I don't know, really messed up tinkling piano. And then I have like a didgeridoo through in there and just have it like vibrating all over the place. And then it goes into something else and kind of hits this climax. And then the outro is I took a bunch of drum machines and ran them all through distortion pedals. And then they're all kind of pounding towards the end, and then I bring the kind of intro, which is the original thing I written on a synth, kind of back in to kind of hopefully tie the whole piece together.
Yeah, well, okay. We'll listen to one more here, and this is Processional.
Yes.
A little bit of a tongue twister there.
Yeah, that's the whole point.
What is that What else is the point of that song, I guess? Is there – set it up for us.
Sure. So I guess Recessional Processional was actually written – it was one of the first songs I actually wrote on a keyboard after I figured out how to play the keyboard, which sounds ridiculous. Like you're interviewing a guy who just learned how to play the keyboard. But the whole point of the song was it was written deep in the recession. It was like 2008, 2009. Like the original structure of the song was written. And the whole country was in this kind of just bottomless pit of despair. And so I guess it's a really happy song. So I don't know if it's an answer to that. But it was kind of reverting back to the point when I didn't have any money. Like when I was in college, I was like dead broke living in a basement with just a sleeping bag. And I remember those times as really fondly. So everybody's talking about this. Oh, we're all broke. Oh, gosh, I don't have any money. And I was thinking about those times as like, wow, I don't know. I had a book and like a stereo and a sleeping bag. And it was awesome. And I would like get a six-pack of beer and listen to music. And it was wonderful. And so I'm kind of looking back at that time as just sort of this, I was like celebrating, I don't know, I guess the Buddha would be down with this, like celebrating having no material goods.
Plus you were a Lake Effect intern.
I was a Lake Effect intern, so I was in deep need of money.
All right, well, let's give this one a listen. Something I especially like to think about when I talk to people who make who produce electronic music, which is how do you balance between the sounds and emotion? I mean, some groups do that really well. Of course, you know, Kraftwerk is, I think, a master at making electronic, really impersonal things sound personal. Mm-hmm. So was that something that entered into your mind? I mean, do you want things to sound human or not human? Approachable by humans, if nothing else?
Hopefully approachable by humans. I've tried playing it for chimpanzees, and they're not really into it. So I think that's a good thing. And yeah, every single song on the album is really derives from some emotion. There's a song on there called Es muss sein, which is German for it must be. I think it was what Beethoven wrote on the top of his last score. I'm no Beethoven, but I copped it. And so that song's really aggressive and angry and kind of mad. so I just wanted to write kind of an angry, driving, just no holds barred song, which is the best I could do, which was that song. And then there were other songs, Anthemist Colors, which is this just – it's almost like I tried to make pop punk into electronic music. And that's just kind of like a driving – like I just wanted to be like an explosion of colors. So I think what I always try to do is try to have each song relay – I try to stick with at least like one feeling that I'm trying to get across because it's not – there's no lyrics really. There's a few lyrics snuck in there. So I think really with electronic music, the only thing you can do is try to get across like one primary emotion.
Well, Paul, it's nice to see you again.
Hey, you too.
After all these years, and congratulations on getting your CD out. I know that's a lot of work.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Former Lake Effect production assistant Paul Schwarzkopf lives in Minnesota now. He performs electronic music under the band name Manual Controller, which has a CD out called Salutations. We will go out with a track from the CD called Gentleman in the Hat. Paul Schwarzkopf spoke with Dan Harmon. You'll find a link to more about Manual Controller from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Thursday's Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, a concerted effort to have doctors, child care workers, and other professionals in 12 Milwaukee zip codes take on the challenge of children's health and wellness screening. Plus, Melinda Myers offers some suggestions for restoring your waterlogged lawn and garden, and then we'll talk flowers in advance of Mother's Day. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.